Thank you. And I guess turning up the sound helps. All right, now I'll turn it over to you.
Okay. Hi, everybody. I'm Guy Brandenburg. I'm the current president of National Capital Astronomers, and I want to welcome you to this meeting and to presentation by Dr. Hamill, which is over here. Is that your daughter, right?
It is my daughter, yeah.
Okay. And I understand you have your birthday next week, basically,
Yeah, that's right.
on the day of the lunar eclipse. Happens to be my wife's birthday also. And today is International Women's Day, which has been celebrated for now about 108 years. So, auspicious date. Okay. Oops. All right. So, our agenda, welcome. And by the way, how many people have been to an NCA meeting before? Okay. How many people, this is your first time? Okay. Hope it's not too painful. Hope you get something out of it. How many people have seen Omega Centauri that we were talking about? No? Just okay. Really cool. If you get to the Southern Hemisphere, I hope you get to see it. It's amazing.
I had an
So
umbrella.
if
I had an
yes.
umbrella, as I said. That doesn't count.
He said he has an umbrella that has Omega Centauri on it.
Oh, I guess that counts.
Okay.
Okay, so if you haven't done so, go ahead and sign up for the NCA listserv. You can send me an email if you haven't, if you don't know how to do that. We're going to go over the Exploring the Sky schedule again, observing report, talk about the science fairs, a little bit about the lunar eclipse next weekend, and the NCA swags. And at the end, we'll have observing UMD telescopes. And okay, so I just want to thank our officers and volunteers who put this together. Carl, our vice president, he's retiring. We need somebody new. So please think about that. It's a very important job getting new speakers. Jim Simpson's been doing a great job of being Secretary of Treasury. Brian Tomich has just agreed to become our assistant. Todd does an incredible job with our newsletter. Elizabeth does an incredible job as a webmaster and head of the observatory. And Jay Miller has been coordinating the Lonely Sky for years. Chong Wang is our newest trustee and really been helping get volunteer to come out for public observing. And Gail Gomez and Zach Gleiberman been very active with Sidewalk Astronomy. So here's the schedule. I think it's actually in current Stardust, so I'm not going to repeat it. That should be fun. And keep in mind that for many people, looking through our telescopes, either in Rock Creek Park or on a street corner, is for many people the first time they've ever actually looked through a telescope. And they're invariably so grateful that we come out and do that. And it's
I can make a little comment on that.
sure.
For April, we will not have a planetarium show, but it is because there are staffing is somewhat variable, but it's possible that beginning with the May meeting, we will be able to have planetarium shows beginning an hour before the meeting. So I will let people know, before that what how things are going.
Yeah, that really increases the number of people that come out, and it's a
Yeah.
thing. It was canceled last year because of budget active problems, but hopefully we'll get it going again this year. And concerning the science fairs, we now have people for the DC Science Fair for Montgomery. And for PG and Fairfax, we need an additional person. Milt, are you here? Okay. So, anybody want to volunteer for the Prince George's one? What that means is March 15th, that is next weekend, you give up a morning and you go around to all these projects. Anybody, any volunteers? Yeah. And then it's really a lot of fun. Some of the projects are great, some of them are not so great, but encourage them all. We really should have additional people. Loudon is a bit far, but we could use two volunteers there.
So, set of criteria.
The criteria for judges or for the projects? Okay, for the projects, they should obviously be related to astronomy in some manner. And that could be a lot of different things. And when you go there, they have listings of all the different projects, and they have them listed by, they have these special categories. And what you should do is take some time and go through those and circle the ones that sound like they could be promising. And we give to all of the people that we look at the projects for, we just give them a little card saying your project has been reviewed. And the ones that are really outstandingly good, we don't use a rubric, although you can. Every STEM fair, science fair has a rubric that they use for their own judges that the county or city or whatever does. We're not a regular judge. We're a special outside organization type judge. Now, the qualifications are A, that you know some science, and B, that you have some common sense, and that you C, that you like helping young people. And you're encouraging them, but you don't have to have special qualifications for that. Could you say that again? Oh, just about it goes pretty much from 7:30 in the morning to about a little bit after 12. Most of them will give you a little, coffee and donuts in the morning, and maybe a sandwich lunch in the at lunch. Say, okay, great. Thank you. Thank you very much. And by the way, the ones that we really like, and by the way, hopefully you have another person and you discuss these projects, and then you tell the people who are running the project, we want to award something to, Susie and Jim on their project. And what they get is they get an opportunity to come here and present to us, NCA, in June. And they also get a subscription to Sky and Telescope, and that's kind of expensive. We do it for 1 year, and they get a membership in NCA, and they get some NCA swag. So it's not an overwhelming thing, but you give up a morning. So talk to me later if you want to do this. Any other questions on that? It's a lot of fun, and the projects are quite interesting. You cannot take photos. You cannot get their phone numbers. You cannot ask them for their email address. You have to go through the system of the county. Okay, so here's the swag, and anybody who actually takes the time to represent NCA will get their choice of whichever thing they like. Let's see what else. That's pretty much it. Oh, wait a second. Well, the other thing. Let's go back a little bit. Come on. All right. So yeah. So next. Oh yeah. Gail, did you want to say something about observing reports in sidewalk astronomy?
Well,
Why don't you stand up?
a few days ago, I believe it was Saturday, I was using my 10-inch Schmidt-Cassegrain telescope to look at this really beautiful star cluster, Messier 37. I believe that's in near the Gemini constellation around there, Auriga, I think. Yeah, Auriga. It's sort of like a cheap globular cluster, sort of. Looks almost like a globular. It's really beautiful. Lots of colors. I saw this on a relatively decent transparency night from a parking lot. I guess it's actually a driveway out in Columbia Heights here in Washington, D.C. And yeah, I mean it's a really beautiful object. I suggest people who haven't seen it, you should look at it. It's pretty cool.
Okay. And tell us a little bit about what you've been doing in various places around the city for letting people look through the telescopes and stuff.
Well, usually probably on weekends too, and like just times when the sky's clear and I'm not tired, I suppose. I like to set up right outside Columbia Heights in the intersection between Mount Pleasant Street and Irving Street. There's a restaurant there, and I set up in front of the restaurant with the help of my next door neighbor. And usually stay there for a couple of hours, usually 3 hours or so. I like to bring out my handmade 8-inch Dobsonian telescope, and we usually use it to look at like stuff like the planets mostly. And if the moon's out, the moon. And yeah, we're doing it quite often this month, and it's been a lot of fun. We've also done it out in Woodley Park, and yeah, it's a lot of fun. Saturn astronomy.
Yeah, and one of the neat things about this is that you've discovered an app or website, actually. You just take an ordinary cell phone, any cell phone, you strap it to your telescope so it doesn't move, and then you find a target that's somewhere in the neighborhood of whatever you're trying to find, some Messier object, and let's say Jupiter's nearby, and you tell the app, I'm looking at Jupiter, and then it only uses the internal gyros and accelerometers and stuff like that, and it'll tell you how to get to whatever your target is. And you can do that with an ordinary Dobsonian or any telescope, even if you can't make out a single or you're only a couple of stars, and it's rather amazing. And okay. Anybody else have any announcements they'd like to make?
I'd like to say on the observing the sidewalk astronomy, if you're doing anything representing NCA, if you let me know and tell me how many people you've spoken to or how many people have looked through the telescope, I can report it to Night Sky Network and put it down there, and we'll maybe get some swag from the Night Sky Network.
Okay, that shouldn't be too hard. So, yes.
But I got to know how many people you've talked to, or how many people have looked through the telescopes.
Okay.
It's actually good to also let Jay know ahead of time so he can put it on a calendar, because sometimes people actually look for events to do.
Yes.
Let
Yeah, if I can put it in Night Sky Network beforehand, that's even better.
Well, the problem with that is a lot of times we decide in the morning it's going to be nice tonight. Okay.
Okay. I just have, so we've got, I may have missed it. Did y'all talk about the eclipse yet? No.
I didn't talk much.
Okay.
Did you want to say something about it?
Well, the lunar eclipse is Thursday night into Friday morning.
So it starts about like.
Midnight, Thursday night. So Friday morning, Thursday night into Friday morning, it starts like a few minutes before midnight, the part that's noticeable, and it goes to about mid eclipses around 3 a.m. And so right now it looks like it'll be cloudy early in the evening, and then it clears up right in time for the eclipse part. Maybe we're not doing anything here. Do not come here. You do not need a telescope to see the lunar eclipse. You can just you have a window facing in the right direction. You may be able to just observe it looking through your windows, or just throw on a blanket or some jackets over your pajamas and just step outside for a few minutes and look. The students will be doing something on campus, but it's kind of mainly geared for the campus students and everything. And it's also weather dependent. But the other big one that is public is Maryland Day, which is at the end of April, April 26th, last Saturday of the month. And we'll have solar observing and the usual other activities that we have had every year for the last 18 years. And we invite you out for Maryland Day, Saturday the 26th.
Okay. All right. Carl. Oh, yes.
On the topic of the lunar eclipse, a group that will be having a public event for the eclipse is the Analemma Society, the Observatory Park at Turner Farm, which is on Springvale Road in Great Falls. We're going to be open from we plan to be open from 1 a.m. to 5 a.m. then fr Friday morning, and for the public to come and view the eclipse. We have several telescopes, a 6-inch refractor there, C14, I think the C12 or so.
Okay, thank you.
And let's bring your own telescope. If
The website for that?
1 a.m. to 5 a.m.
Website for that?
It's analemma.org.
Analemma.org.
Yeah. Thank you. First, check the website for lower
Are you done?
level.
I'm done.
We should sit to be on. Not
Um,
that I want to be on camera. I just
right in front of this one.
need the light. It's in my notes.
Turn on one of the lights for you.
So I'm happy and actually quite proud to be able to introduce tonight's speaker, Dr. Heidi Hamel. She's here to talk to us about her research and others' research on our solar system using JWST, James Webb Space Telescope. Heidi got her doctorate from the University of Hawaii. And while holding a postdoctoral position at JPL, she was a member of the imaging science team for Voyager 2 when it observed and encountered Neptune, the Voyager 2 Neptune encounter in 1989, which seems to me is not a bad way to start your solar system career. For several years, she was with MIT and the Space Science Institute in Boulder. And over the years, she's used Hubble, the Hubble Space Telescope, many times to study many different targets and aspects of our solar system. And in fact, in 1993, when we were planning for the first Hubble's first servicing mission, where we were going to refurbish it and correct the optics, and basically transform it from a national joke to the iconic telescope that it was meant to be. During that time, in that planning phase, it became apparent that the comet Shoemaker-Levy 9 was deciding to actually crash into Jupiter, and we wanted to make sure we got Hubble refurbished and commissioned in time for that event in July of 1994. And the team that was awarded time on Hubble to view that event in real time, that once in a lifetime event, was headed by Heidi Hamel. She's now an interdisciplinary, or she long before JWST was launched, several years before launch, she was made an interdisciplinary scientist on the telescope on the mission. And she's currently a vice president of the board of directors of the Planetary Society. Several years ago, she became executive vice president of the Association of Universities for Research in Astronomy. That's AURA, AURA, which is an umbrella organization that runs the, among other things, the Space Telescope Science Institute, which in turn runs, among other things, the science operations for Hubble and Webb, and will do the science operations for Nancy Grace Roman Telescope. She's won many awards over the years, the Klimka Roberts Award, the Harold C. Urey Prize for her planetary science, and she's been recognized as a really important science communicator. In 2002, she was a recipient of the Carl Sagan Medal, which is given to, quote, a scientist whose communications have greatly enhanced the general public's understanding of planetary science, unquote. And she even has an asteroid named after her, 3530 Hamel. 3 years ago, she addressed this same group. I don't know if you were here in person or Zoom. Yeah, 3 years ago. She addressed this group, the National Capital Astronomers, speaking on what JWST will be able to tell us about the solar system. So she's back here tonight, and she's got some real data from Webb and other places, and she's going to tell us what she's been learning. Her talk tonight is entitled Exploring the Solar System with the James Webb Space Telescope.
Thank you. So give me a minute to get it set up, because we had to switch computers, and let's make sure this all works. So I share my talk. Let's do this. Let's get this down. And that'll go away. Let's get rid of that. I don't see my cursor. I might have to call my tech support to come up here. That's my daughter.
I don't see your cursor either.
Okay, so now we gotta do this.
Get rid of it first.
Huh? Yeah, get rid of it first. Make it tiny and down. Yes.
Yeah. Okay. I'll let you take it.
Okay.
I go over here.
You can see me as a shadow against the screen, but hopefully you can see the screen. Hello, everybody.
Hello.
My name is Heidi, and I'm here to talk about exploring the solar system with the James Webb Space Telescope. But I'm going to actually start this talk by doing some science, some really basic science, because I want us to all be on the same page when I'm talking about James Webb Space Telescope. So I'm going to start with Isaac Newton. And Isaac Newton did a very important experiment where he had a pinhole in the wall and sunlight came through the pinhole, and he put a prism in front of the hole and he spread out the sunlight into a rainbow of colors, as is shown in this picture. And that rainbow of colors is the visible light that we see. That's a rainbow of colors. But what is important for us to understand is that that rainbow of light doesn't just stop at red or blue. It actually continues to longer wavelengths than red and shorter wavelengths than blue. And we call that the electromagnetic spectrum. It's kind of hard to see there. Can you see that there's other colors around there? Maybe if we turn off some of the fluorescent lights in here, you can see it a little bit better. Yeah, so can you see that there's other wavelengths of light besides just that visible part of the spectrum that we see with our human eyes? And you've heard the names of these. Visible light is what we see, but you've heard of ultraviolet light. You've heard of microwaves. Any of you have a microwave oven? You're cooking with microwave light. You've heard of radio waves. That's what we the radio transmissions. X-rays, if you've ever had a broken bone, you've used X-ray light to image the bone in your arm, and other kinds of things, gamma rays, things like that. And just short, just a long word of visible is the near infrared and the mid infrared. And I'll come back to that because that's what JWST is going to be focused on. But the universe doesn't just emit light at visible wavelengths. The universe emits light at all of the wavelengths. Stars emit light at all of the wavelengths. We, people, we emit light at other wavelengths as well. And so when we do astronomy, we actually want to have telescopes that look at all these different colors of light. And we build them on mountaintops, but the mountaintops don't always help us because we have things like the ozone layer, which absorbs the light in the ultraviolet, X-ray, and gamma rays. And so if you want to do astronomy at those wavelengths, you need your telescopes up above them, either in balloons, rockets, or on spaceships. And something similar happens in the infrared. Our Earth's atmosphere absorbs infrared light. And so that's one reason we put James Webb Space Telescope up above the Earth's atmosphere. But the point is we want all of the wavelengths, all of the time. And James Webb in particular is focused on the mid-infrared and the near-infrared. And why did we pick that? Why did we design James Webb Space Telescope to do that? There's a couple of reasons. How many of you were outside earlier when we were looking through the telescope? How many of you noticed the Orion Nebula? Did you, Orion, the constellation, did you see it? I pointed it out to my daughter. Okay, some of you saw it. All right, well, this is a picture of Orion at visible wavelengths of light. It does not have the blue lines in the sky. They're just there to help you see the constellation. But that's the shape of Orion with the three stars of the belt, and then the Orion Nebula down here on the like a little knife hanging off of the belt. That's the Orion Nebula. This is a visible wavelength image of the sky. Now I'm going to show you the same piece of sky, but in an infrared wavelength. And this is what Orion looks like in infrared light. And you can't see it at visible wavelengths, but all of Orion is swathed in dust. It's a huge dust cloud. And that nebula is a tiny opening that allows us to see into the dust cloud where stars are being born. And so by using infrared light, we can see the dust. We can see the structure of the nebula, which you can't do at visible light. And so that's one reason that infrared is important. Here's a beautiful Hubble image of Jupiter. This is actually not one of my images. This was taken more recently. But it's a beautiful visible wavelength image. The red spot is red, the white clouds are white. But now let me show you an image taken in the infrared with the Gemini Observatory on the summit of Mauna Kea in Hawaii. At the same time, that is an infrared image of Jupiter. And you can see the great red spot is an opening here. There's very dark. All of these bright regions are clear spots in the atmosphere where you can see deeper where it is warmer in the atmosphere. So by looking at infrared light, we can actually tell things about temperatures of objects that we can't see it in the visible wavelengths. And so we'll show you some more JWST images at infrared light as well. Now, JWST's real superpower is not the pictures. I'm going to show you pictures because pictures are fun, but our real superpower is what we call spectroscopy. And that's where you imagine the rainbow of light. And remember, the rainbow of light doesn't stop at red, it keeps going. It doesn't stop at blue, it keeps going. But certain molecules and elements and atoms and compounds out there anywhere, they absorb certain characteristic wavelengths of light. The reason they do it is quantum physics, and I'm not going to go into it here, but we can talk about it if you want to during the Q&A. But by looking at the missing wavelengths of light, we can figure out what is out there in space by looking at the gaps, right? But there are other materials that actually emit extra light. It has to do with their pressure, their temperature, their excitation state. And so there's times where there are light that is added to the spectrum. In the olden days, back when I was a student, in the dawn of time, when dinosaurs ruled the earth, we did not have color printers and we did not have color projectors. So to talk about spectroscopy, what we did is we would sort of draw a line through this, and where the light was missing, the line would go down. And if extra light was added, the light would go up. And so we would generate plots that look like this. And this is called a spectrum. And the positions of these things going down correspond to certain lines in the spectrum, or places when they go up is where there's extra lines added. And the elements that we study, like hydrogen, helium, they have they're like fingerprints. Those lines always occur at the same wavelengths. We know them. That's how we do science in astronomy, where we generally can't get to our objects. So here's an example of a spectroscopy. Now here's a picture of an exploding star called Eta Carina. And this star was imaged by the Hubble Space Telescope. Incredibly cool picture, right? Astronomers, they think that's great, but show me the spectrum. And so when we do that, when we put a slit on there and spread that light out into its constituent colors, you see lines appear. And we know from their wavelengths that these lines are nickel, iron, argon. And not only do we know what they are, by the strengths of the lines, we can tell their temperature. We can figure out their pressure. And if you look at some of these lines, you'll notice how there's sort of curves going to some of those lines. That has to do with the dynamics of the gases that are in that explosion. And so the science that comes from the Hubble Space Telescope and from JWST and most of our major astronomical telescopes, it's mostly coming from spectroscopy, from looking at these spectra. And that's why I wanted to take the time to show that to you, because I'm going to show you spectra from JWST, because if I was with a group of astronomers and we put up a beautiful JWST image, everyone would be like, how nice. That's very pretty. If you put up a spectrum, they're like, oh, whoa, oh my gosh, that's amazing. So that's really where the science is here. Okay, so I wanted to show you why we built JWST, the reason we did. When we look at a nearby star, we see characteristic lines typically from hydrogen, and they're given their Greek letters, alpha, beta, gamma, delta, epsilon, and they go on. But when you look at a star that's a little bit further away, if you look super closely, you notice those lines are shifted just a little bit to the red. It's kind of hard to see in the nearby universe, but if you look at a very distant galaxy, this shift is now noticeable. You see how all the lines are shifted off into the red. And when we look at the most distant galaxies, really distant galaxies, now those lines are shifted out of the visible and into the infrared part of the spectrum. And the reason we built JWST, its purpose was to study the most distant and earliest galaxies that ever formed in our universe. And so what wavelength do we need to look at? Infrared. That is why we built JWST as an infrared telescope. That is where the light from the earliest galaxies is found. And so here's two cartoons showing JWST and Hubble to scale. And there was a little human for scale in the middle too. And so everything about JWST is designed with infrared in mind. The reason the mirror is gold is not just because it looks pretty. It's gold because gold is a really efficient infrared reflector. And the reason that we don't have a tube enclosing the telescope, like the Dobbs that you saw earlier tonight, like Hubble, there's no tube. This is an outer space. It's because the tube actually emits heat, and heat is infrared light. And so to see the earliest galaxies, we can't have a tube there because it just swamps the galaxies. The giant sun shields that you see there, which are the size of tennis courts, they're there to protect the telescope and keep it cold so that any light from the earliest galaxies, any warmth from the earliest galaxies is what we see, not the light from the sun or the earth or the moon. So everything about this telescope was designed to optimize it for the infrared. Okay. And that science, the light from the very first galaxies, is the key science of JWST. And if you want to ask me about that in the Q&A, we can talk about that, but that's not why I'm here. I'm here because I realized 30 years ago that if this telescope was powerful enough to see the most distant galaxies in the universe, it could see stuff in our solar system too. And not only that, it can see galaxies between here and the most distant ones. And so even though light from the first galaxies was our core science theme, we had another science theme that was called assembly of galaxies over time. And we had a third science theme called the birth of stars and protoplanetary systems. This is watching how stars and planetary systems form. And finally, the fourth theme was planetary systems and the origins of life. And that is the science theme that I have been working on with James Webb for the last 25 years. The exploration of our solar system with the James Webb Space Telescope. So what can we do? This is a cartoon. You know, you heard about the grand alignment that just took place, right? Yeah, it didn't look like this, all right? This is just a cartoon sort of showing you all the various planets. JWST is right here. It's not orbiting Earth. It is actually in it's at the Earth-Sun L2 point. So a line from the sun to the Earth and another million miles. That's where it's located. I put it in there. It is not to scale here, all right? It's not bigger than the Earth. But I put it there to show you that the sun shield blocks the Earth, the moon, and the sun. That's what it's designed to do. And basically that means it blocks everything interior here. So we will never have JWST data of Venus, and we will not have JWST observations of the moon, Earth, or Mercury, or the sun. Somebody actually asked us that once. We're like, no, we will not point JWST at the sun. But everything else in the solar system was fair game. And in 2002, that was what I looked like in 2002 with my little baby, Lucas. I wrote a proposal to NASA to use this, what was then called Next Generation Space Telescope, to study the solar system. And in 2003, my proposal was one of six that was selected from around the world. And the six of us who were selected became what they called interdisciplinary scientists. That meant we could use every instrument on JWST to do the science that we wanted to do. And part of that was we were granted, the six of us, the six interdisciplinary scientists, each got guaranteed 100 hours of JWST time to do whatever we wanted to do with, as long as we didn't break the telescope. More on that later. And this was called the guaranteed time observations, GTO time. So if I slip up and say GTO time at some point, this is what I'm talking about, my 100 hours of guaranteed time. Now that was 2003. And then years went by, many years went by, more, a decade went by, almost into another decade went by. And JWST, there's a lot of story. We can talk about it if you want. It took a long time to build this very, very complex telescope. But during that time, I built up a team to use my GTO time. And so I wanted to have a shout out to all of these young people. I decided for my time, which was for the solar system, that I was going to do a solar system sampler. And so you can see under their names, you see things like asteroids, occultations, Mars, Saturn's rings, giant planets, Titan, comets, KBOs, and NEOs. That stands for near Earth objects. Those are asteroids or comets that could hit the Earth. And we can have a whole discussion about that in the Q&A if you want just today. Andy and Christina and I and several of our colleagues got time to study the asteroid 2024 YR4. And if you've been paying attention, you know that 2 weeks ago, we thought that was going to hit the Earth. And so we applied for some special time with JWST to try to measure its size. Fortunately, the asteroid is not going to hit the Earth. We've refined its orbit, and that's good, but we are still doing the size measurements, and they are literally happening right now as I am speaking to you. They are being taken with James Webb Space Telescope and are going to be radioed back to the Earth in the middle of the night tonight. So when I wake up in the middle of the night, I'm going to be checking my email to see how that all turned out. Anyway, oh, that's my science team. And these are the folks who really did the heavy lifting. I was the cheerleader for the program. And we set up a program to do the solar system sampler. Not only my GTO time, but I mentioned the other IDS scientists, the other interdisciplinary scientists. They wanted to also look at some of the Kuiper Belt objects like Pluto and all of Pluto's friends and relations. There was a Jupiter System Early Release Science program, and they studied the Jupiter system, and then what we call GO programs. GO programs are regular observers, just anybody. If you want to use JWST once a year, there's a call, and you can write a proposal, and if it's good enough science, it can be selected. So what everything that you see here in blue and white are observations that we made in the first year and a half of JWST for the solar system. And as I mentioned, the GTO, the GO time, the proposals, we are now we're going into the fourth cycle of JWST, the fourth year of observations. And this pie chart is a breakdown of the different kinds of science that JWST does, from the high redshift galaxies, gas, dust, and the interstellar medium, and then the orange swaths, they're the solar system. The blue swaths are exoplanets. And so those triangles, those wedges that I pulled out there, those are the solar system observations that are still happening as we speak. Like I said, literally as we speak, JWST is making solar system observations of an asteroid. So that's sort of an overview of solar system stuff. And I just wanted to point this out. Remember I talked about spectroscopy? When you break out how much is spectroscopy and how much is imaging? More than two-thirds of what the scientists request is spectroscopy, and only one-third of it is the imaging. I just have to say this over and over again because people get so excited about the pictures, but the science is the spectroscopy, and that's why people ask for the spectra. Okay, so let's talk about what we did. The program that my team, my GTO team set up was to explore basically what the capabilities of JWST were for things in our solar system. Things in our solar system are bright. You know, we can see them with our eyes out there, unlike the most distant galaxies in the universe. Things that are fast moving, comets, asteroids, things like Jupiter and Mars, they move quickly in the sky. Things that are dynamic, that change rapidly. Three-dimensional, I'll talk about the three-dimensional structures we're pulling out for planetary atmospheres. And then distant. And distant, I have it in quotes because it's distant for the solar system. But remember what JWST does is like the most distant galaxies in the whole universe. So our stuff, by comparison, is not distant at all. But for us in the solar system, it's distant. It's Kuiper Belt objects, Pluto, Sedna, Quawar, all of those guys. So let's talk about things that are bright. When we were outside tonight, people were pointing up the object that was almost at the top of the sky near the meridian, the bright object that was?
Jupiter.
There's Jupiter. And so this was an image that was captured by the ERS team. But I worked with that team to develop this particular image because Judy Schmidt and I have gone back a long ways. She helped me do a lot of reprocessing of our Shoemaker Levy 9 Jupiter data. So I knew she had the tools to do this Jupiter imaging. So she and I worked on creating this particular image. So let's zoom in on a couple of interesting things in this image. First of all, the Great Red Spot, of course, is not red in this picture because this is not a visible image. This is an infrared image. It's a couple of different infrared images that have been composited together to show different structures in the atmosphere. So let's zoom up to the top here. And what you see at the top here, this reddish glow up there, that is the aurorae, the northern aurora on Jupiter. And what was very interesting to us was how far it extended above the cloud tops. You could see a trace here, if you look closely, of an auroral oval. And some of you, I think, may be familiar with Hubble images that show the aurorae glowing in ultraviolet light. But here we're looking at the same aurorae glowing in the infrared. And I just last week saw a beautiful comparison of some new side-by-side Hubble JWST auroral observations of Jupiter that I think you will see probably in a month or so, which are absolutely spectacular, showing these auroral ovals. So that was interesting. Something that caught all of us by surprise is if you look off to the side here and you see what looks like a line along the edge of Jupiter, yeah, that shouldn't be there. That's the shadowed limb of Jupiter. That should be in shadow. But something is glowing in the infrared. And when we first got these images where we saw some that edge there, people's first reaction was, well, it must be out of focus. We're like, no, it is not out of focus. We spent the entire commissioning period making sure everything was in focus. What we think is happening now is this is a high altitude ionospheric glow from the auroral activity that is transported meridionally all the way around the planet. And it's so faint that you normally cannot see it. But with JWST's really sensitive cameras, we could actually pick up that faint glow that had never been seen even by spacecraft that had been at Jupiter before. But it's real. And it was a surprise discovery in our very first Jupiter images with JWST. We zoom in here. I already mentioned that it's not red because it's not visible, but you might be wondering, why is it so bright? Why is it so white? Actually, the reason that it's white is that there's a whole lot of high altitude clouds there. Any place that you see brightening here is high altitude, and that's because the rest of the atmosphere has a molecule called methane in it, and methane is a super strong absorber. Remember I talked about some of the molecules absorbing and taking away light? Methane takes away infrared light really, really effectively. So the only way that you could have anything scattered back to you is by putting it up above the methane. So by definition, anything bright is a high altitude cloud here. That's three dimensionality in the images. And I mentioned how powerful JWST was in terms of the dynamics. I wanted to show you one more Jupiter image, just two wavelengths, not quite as pretty. But what I wanted to show you is if you look carefully here, do you see the ring? Mm-hmm. Can you see the ring? Mm-hmm. Right here? Right there. That's the ring. Did you know Jupiter had rings? Yeah, Jupiter has rings. All the giant planets do. Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune, they all have rings. And it turns out JWST is incredibly good at seeing the rings. And those rings are a million times fainter than the planet. That's the dynamic range in this camera that we have, a factor of a million. And that is allowing all kinds of great science, not only for the solar system, but other kinds of science as well. Okay, so some other new things that we learned from JWST. One of my colleagues, Ricardo Hueso and his team, they measured these high altitude clouds in the equatorial region, and they were actually able to find a jet stream. Let's see. Oh, I can get all the way over there. You see there's a peak that sticks out right there, that bright orange peak. That's a high-speed jet stream on Jupiter that had never been seen before. Not even with the Cassini spacecraft as it flew by, not with the Galileo spacecraft that orbited Jupiter for many years. It just didn't have the sensitivity at the right wavelengths to pick out that kind of dynamical activity. And so, again, very exciting Jupiter science coming from JWST. And so, really happy with how that all turned out. But the superpower is spectroscopy. And so these are spectra of Jupiter in the red and orange, and then Saturn in the blue. And every wiggle that you see here is data. It is not noise. There is no noise in this spectrum. Everything you see are molecular phosphine lines. They are acetylene, ethane. They're carbon dioxide, hydrogen. Other complex hydrocarbons, you can see other things like germanium and ammonia, H3 plus, more phosphine. This is when we started planning for this, we were working with textbook spectra, like spectra that you theoretical spectra. These data are better than the theoretical spectra that we have. They're better than the laboratory data that we have. We are starting in the JWST data, not only for Jupiter, but for Kuiper Belt objects, dust clouds, stars. We are finding lines that we have no laboratory analog for. We don't know what they are. And so it's a whole new ball game because this spectroscopy is so amazing. The quality is just exceptional, better than we had anticipated. We thought it was going to be good, but it's knock your socks off good. And so we're super excited about that. And I'll show some other stuff later on about how we use this in conjunction with the images. Okay, another bright object that is up tonight near the moon is Mars. And we tried to look at Mars with JWST. It was really hard. Mars saturated our detectors a lot of the time. And so we couldn't do full disk imaging, but we did get pieces of imaging of Mars. And here is an infrared map of Mars. This is a cartoon map showing us the topography. So this is not data. This is a map that was created after a spacecraft flying by. But this is actual JWST data. And this is thermal data, mid-infrared data. Stuff that's yellow is hot. Things that are blue is cold. And the subsolar point is right here, where it's showing you. That's where it's hottest and it gets coolest. But then you've got this big structure there. And that structure is the Hellas Basin. If you look at this map, it's a big circular depression on Mars. And well, I remember when my colleague who was in charge of this, Geronimo Villanueva, showed me this image. I'm like, why is Hellas Basin cold? He's like, well, it's not cold. Can't be cold. I'm like, but it's dark. And so it's cold. He's like, no. And so I'm like, well, you gotta explain it to me. And I'm like, so what he t said was, remember I talked about the lines in the spectrum? At this wavelength, there's a carbon dioxide line, all right? And so there's a big bump where there's light. But this basin is a big hole on Mars, right? It's a big, deep basin. And so at the bottom of the basin where the carbon dioxide is, there's higher pressure on the carbon dioxide because it's at the bottom of the basin. There's a whole lot of atmosphere. And what happens is that high pressure, changes the line shape. It makes the line broader, but not as tall. And so when you don't have it as tall, but make it broader, that means the brightness of it goes down. So you are not seeing temperature, you're seeing pressure. You're seeing pressure here. And it's not intuitive at all. And so it was like, had to think about it for a while, but it all made sense when we actually sat down and did all the math. And so I just thought I'd share that with you. You have to be careful when you look at pictures. There's a lot of science behind a picture to really truly understand it. Okay, and we did spectra as well. This is a spectrum of Mars. And what you see here, this shifting here, that's water lines.
these absorption features, these are carbon dioxide lines. This structure that you see in here that you might be thinking that looks like noise, that is not noise, that is carbon monoxide lines. And one of the things I'm not showing here, because we're still working on it, is methane. There's a Martian methane mystery. Some observations from the Earth say that there is methane on Mars. Some of the rovers on Mars say, no, there's no methane here. And other in situ spacecraft say, well, yeah, actually, sometimes there's methane there. So it's a mystery. What's driving it? We don't really know. And one of the things we'll be working on is our JWST spectroscopy to see what we can learn about this Martian methane mystery. All right, so fast moving objects. Comets are fast moving objects, but I wanted to talk about a special kind of comet that you may not be familiar with. Now, if we look down on the solar system here, here's Neptune, Uranus, Saturn, Jupiter, and then right in here, you see that sort of whitish fuzz ball stuff? That's the asteroid belt. Comet Halley is a comet you've probably heard of. How many of you actually saw it back in 1986? I did. Yeah. So Comet Halley, we see it when it comes swooping in, but then it goes way far out, and then it comes back every 76 years. So if you didn't see it in 1986 when it was here, you're going to have to wait 76 more years. I won't be here. Maybe the young folk in this audience will see it. But I want to talk about a different kind of comet. This kind of comet right here is actually called a main belt comet. It's a comet that is in the asteroid belt. And you might be saying, well, isn't that an asteroid? And I'm like, no, actually it's not, because it seems to have a coma. It seems to have an atmosphere around it. And that's what a comet is. And so there are only 16 of these known, 16 main belt comets. And so we looked at one of them called 238P Reed with the spectroscopy capabilities of JWST. And what we discovered was the very first detection of water vapor on this main belt comet. And that was the telling us what the trigger of the cometary activity was water. And here is a spectrum. You can see this big bump, and you can see we're modeling it with the blue and the magenta lines as water. And there's other stuff too. There's carbon dioxide, which is very typical in comets. But this was the first detection ever of a main belt comet with water. And why do we care about that? Because one of the questions in solar system science is, where did Earth get its water? Where did the water on Earth come from? And there is one whole school of thought that the water that we have on Earth was delivered by asteroids and comets. And so to be able to find water in the main belt of comets strengthens the idea that water was delivered from not only comets, but also from asteroids as well. Okay, now a few years ago, we did an experiment called the double asteroid redirect test. This is where we went to a double asteroid, Didymos, and it has a moon, Dimorphos, that's in orbit around Didymos. And we did a test to see if we could change the orbit of that asteroid moon. Why would we want to do that? Remember I mentioned earlier on about the asteroid that we thought might be hitting the Earth, 2024 YR4? Well, if it had stayed on the collision course with Earth and was going to hit the Earth in 2032, we would want to be able to change its trajectory so it wouldn't hit the Earth. So this was a test. Can we actually whack this little moon of this asteroid and change its orbit? And, you know, to make a long story short, the answer was, yes, we did. We whacked it with a spacecraft. We measured its period of rotation around the main body before it hit, and we measured again after it hit, and we changed the orbit. But we wanted to look at that with JWST. Every telescope on Earth was trying to observe the impact itself. And the problem was that this was a near-Earth asteroid. It was moving almost four times faster than we were allowed to track the telescope. And they said, no, we can't do that. And we're like,
oh, come on, please. And the engineers, they're like, yeah, they were awesome. The engineers, they came up with a way to allow us to do it. We almost broke the telescope. And we're only able to image about half of it. And then we lost the tracking because it was going so fast that JWST was just not able to keep up. So I'm going to show you a movie, but you'll only see half of the movie because I'm only showing you like the half that we could actually see the whole thing. So here's the movie, and that's why it's off to the edge there. But if you look closely, this is the, it starts faint and then explosion. That's what it hit. And you can see boulders being ejected off of it. You see the boulder flying off. And we did the same experiment with Hubble as well. And we were able to track dozens of boulders flying off of this thing. So we can protect the Earth. That was our takeaway from this. And JWST helped us. And like I said, we also are helping by measuring the sizes of these objects, like we're doing, like literally right now while I'm talking to you. So that's dynamic, but there are other things that are dynamic in our solar system. Titan is a large moon of Saturn, and it has a very thick atmosphere, very hard to see through the atmosphere. And so this was our pre-JWST planning, showing a Cassini image and showing this is the grid that we were going to be observing with JWST. This is one of our JWST images and another one. There are two different infrared wavelengths. One of them, you cannot see through the clouds. They're too thick. But in this one, you can actually see through the clouds and see surface structure on Titan. But what's really interesting to us was this thing up here. That is actually a bright cloud, and it's over a place called the lake region on Titan. Titan has rain and rivers and lakes, but they're not made of water. They're made of hydrocarbons. They're methane, ethane, gasoline, essentially. And that is what forms clouds and rain and rivers and lakes. And that region is where we know from the Cassini spacecraft that there are lakes. And so we have a whole bunch of images from Keck Observatory in Hawaii and JWST working together. And in this cartoon, it shows you every column is a date. And then every time there's an X, we don't detect anything. But if there's a cartoon of a cloud, we are detecting things. And so you can see that on some dates, clouds are up high and the clouds are down low. On other dates, clouds are very high and down and up again. We are actually seeing convection. We are seeing cumulus clouds going up and down over the lake region. So we're watching the weather evolve in real time on Titan with JWST. And that was really, really exciting. And so that's been submitted for publication right now. I like this one. What you're looking at here is a star. And then that little guy scooting by is an object called Chirriclo. It's what we call a centaur. It's kind of like a comet, but it never gets close to the sun. It's beyond the orbit of Saturn, between Saturn and Neptune. That's where the centaurs typically are. And this centaur got really, really, really close to a star. In fact, we thought it was going to block out the star. And we proposed these observations. They're called occultation observations. And then 2 weeks before the event, we did a standard course trajectory maneuver on the spacecraft to keep it in its nice little orbit around the L2 point. And it shifted the spacecraft just enough that we actually missed the body. So here's a cartoon showing you Chirriclo. But Chirriclo has a ring system. Can you believe that? It's like saying an asteroid has a ring system. And some of them do, believe it or not. And it turns out that the star, although the star missed the body, Chirriclo, it did hit the rings. And this is our observation. Starlight, starlight, starlight blocked by the rings. And then starlight, starlight, starlight on the other side blocked by the rings again. And by doing that, we can measure the thickness of the rings, compare them with the rings thicknesses that had been seen earlier, and it looks like they're changing with time. So these rings on these small bodies are very unstable. We also did spectroscopy, because that's what we do with JWST, and we found a lot of water ice in a particularly odd crystalline form. So I'm going to move quickly because I'm running out of time here. We also studied this moon, Enceladus, of Saturn. Enceladus is embedded in a blue ring. And here's our JWST image. And what we saw was this vast, vast plume of water. When we did the spectroscopy of that plume, every point in that plume was water. And so we knew that there was a plume there because Cassini had seen this. But what we saw with JWST is that it was not just here. It extended for thousands and thousands of miles. And the volume of water is something like the equivalent of 62,000 swimming pools per day. That's how much water is pouring out of this moon. And so it's a very dynamic place. Very, very cool. 3D. Here's one of my favorite planets, Neptune, and its beautiful ring system. But what I'm going to show you here is moving through the spectrum. And every time we get to a different wavelength, we have a different picture. And so all those pictures are pictures of Neptune. But by looking at Neptune at different wavelengths, we sense different altitudes, high, medium, and low. And you can see how the planet changes what it looks like. That tells us the chemistry at the different altitudes. It tells us the dynamics at those altitudes. And so this is just a huge treasure trove of data. The fact that we have, for every point in that spectrum, we have full disk images of Neptune. And so it's taken us several years to get this data analyzed, and it is just being submitted now for publication. And I think I mentioned, I showed these earlier, Jupiter and Saturn. We could do the same thing with Jupiter and Saturn, except Jupiter and Saturn are so big that we can only look at tiny windows on the planets when we do this three-dimensional thing. So I'm going to show you the same thing I showed you for Neptune, but for Saturn. But I'll only show you the polar regions and some mid-latitudes because that's all that we could take the data for. We don't have full disk images, but it's the same concept. And so a same thing where we're scanning through different wavelengths there, and you can see the polar region, and then you can see these mid-latitudes turning on at other wavelengths. And that is going to be allowing us to make essentially tomography of the atmosphere of Saturn. And I don't have a slide of it here, but we're doing the same thing with the great red spot of Jupiter, where we're going to have sort of three-dimensional structure of the great red spot of Jupiter. And there's a lot of science that we pull out of it. A lot of it is technical geeky stuff like reversal of stratospheric circulation, the North Polar stratospheric vortex. We get excited about stuff like that because it's all there in the data. And finally, the distant things. So the distant things are the Kuiper Belt. So the Kuiper Belt is this huge collection of objects that lie outside the orbit of Neptune. This blue line is the orbit of Neptune. And you can see that there's a huge cloud of them there, right? And I know that your favorite one, and you're gonna ask me about it, is Pluto. And so here it is. It's not that big, it's just blown up here so you can see it, but that's Pluto. And Pluto has a tilted orbit. All of these other Kuiper Belt objects also have orbits like Pluto. Some of them are so similar to Pluto, we call them Plutinos, like little Plutos. And Pluto is just another trans-Neptunian object, although it's a pretty big one. Not the biggest, that's Eris. So we flip-flop between KBO, Kuiper Belt object, and TNO, trans-Neptunian object. So I put them both up there so in case I slip up. They're all the same thing. KBOs, RTNOs, it's just different names. We have actually sent spacecraft to KBOs. The New Horizons spacecraft flew by Pluto, that's this one. And then several years later, it flew by Erika, that's this one. So you can see right away that KBOs or TNOs come in very different shapes. Some are like doubles, and then Pluto is like that. But there's another one we actually flew by, we think. It's a TNO, and that is Neptune's moon Triton. Triton is a captured Kuiper Belt object. I don't know if you knew that. It's not a natural moon of Neptune. It actually orbits backwards, and that is why we think it was captured by Neptune. So that is another TNO, but these are the three I just showed you are the only three that we have pictures of. There will be no more pictures. Only will only be spectra, all right? But that's okay, because there's going to be a lot of spectra. And they were a major target. There were dozens and dozens and dozens of these studied. And earlier this year, in January, I was at a big meeting in Meudon. This is the Observatoire du Meudon in Paris. And there was an entire session about these objects, about TNOs, about their surface composition, their irradiated ices, methanol on them. And I just wanted to share just like two bits of conversation. I was a note taker at the meeting along with Stephanie Milam, my number two. She and I were taking notes during the session, trying to figure out like what was going on here. We now have sort of three classes of Kuiper Belt objects that we call bowls. And the bowl, this is the bowl here, the water bowl. You see that big loop in the blue? That's the water bowl. Then there's something they call double dip here. And that is carbon dioxide and carbon monoxide along with organic materials. And then something they call cliffs. But now we've studied so many of them that we now have cliff one and cliff two. And at this meeting, I learned for the first time that there's now cliff 2A and cliff 2B. So we're starting to learn so much about Kuiper Belt objects that we're classifying them and putting them together. And this is a more technical diagram. That was a cartoon that I showed you. I'm showing you the actual technical diagram to give you a sense of just some of the kinds of stuff that we're looking at. Up above is laboratory data. And then below is the actual objects. Sedna, Gongong, and Qawar are three very large and one very distant Kuiper Belt object. And it just shows you the quality. If you look in here, the kinds of stuff that we're seeing, the level of chemistry that we're doing here in the Kuiper Belt is just what it's allowing us to do is actually piece together where these objects must have formed to have the chemistry that they actually have on them. And we couldn't do that before because we didn't have the chemistry. And now with JWST, we have this incredibly remarkable chemistry. And so here's a little dialogue that took place at the meeting between, this was 7 weeks ago. So it's the 9th of January. I guess that was 8 weeks ago now. I said in our notes, so for the Kuiper Belt, the JWST data is now starting to get to the level of complexity that we have seen in the asteroid belt. Although if I'm following this, because I'm just trying to understand it, the arguments are that this complexity is primordial. This is where they formed, not evolutionary. This is not complexity that was driven by change. But Stephanie says, well, kind of, yes, but the JWST data also suggest that radiation from the sun and from the interstellar medium is altering this primordial ice. And we both know that solar and interstellar medium radiation cooks everything. But if we could disentangle the chemistry with this JWST data, that may be the insight we need to understand the evolution of the early solar system. And I'm showing you this is because we're figuring this out in real time. This was like, you know, this was, you know, earlier this year. And if you like pictures, it might explain how we got from this cartoon of our early solar system, which all filled with gas and dust, to the solar system that we have now, this structure. How did we get from here to here? This new data from JWST is what was going to tell us this story. And it's all coming together like right now. And it's incredibly exciting if you're a planetary astronomer, because This is what we're trying to do. We're trying to figure out where the solar system came from, and we have the data to do it now. And not only is it important for our solar system, but I'm going to show you a picture from one of our very large arrays on the ground called ALMA. And what you're seeing here, every one of these things, is another planetary system in formation around another star. And so you can see that they have some have structure, some do not. Some have what look like nascent planets forming. So the information that we're getting from JWST in our solar system is now ground truth. for how planetary systems, how our planetary system formed with actual measurements of the objects. And so it's an incredible time. That's all I can say, is to just to have this transformation in our understanding taking place right in front of our very eyes. So that was a really quick summary of our solar system exploration in all of these different realms. And there's so much more. I didn't even talk about things like Europa. If that's one of your favorite satellites, I can tell you about Europa. Some brand new auroral observations of Neptune, first time ever. And so that is something that we have in press right now. Callisto, another cool moon. And we didn't even talk much about Uranus, one of my favorite planets. And your favorite solar system object here. If I didn't mention your favorite, ask me about it during the Q&A, because I'll tell you what we did or not with JWST. So remember I showed you that picture of me in 2002 with little baby Lucas? That's the year that I wrote my proposal to use this telescope to study the solar system. Everything I just showed you, I was dreaming of at that time. 20 years later, in 2022, that's me with little baby Lucas. And that is when we got our first data. It took that long to go from the dream I had, my proposal, to actually getting the data, all right? So building these kinds of big missions is a generational thing. And that's why I'm happy there's some young people here, because you are the ones who are going to be the future. And what about the future? 2042, we actually have enough fuel. We had such a perfect launch. We have enough fuel to still be observing with JWST in 2042. I will not show you what I'm going to look like in 2042. I don't know, but I'm hoping JWST will still be up. And we are also right now working on the next mission. We don't stop. We are working now on something that we call the Habitable Worlds Observatory. This is a new mission that we hope to launch in 2039 to find a living Earth. Use spectroscopy to study the atmosphere of an Earth-like planet around a sun-like star and see the signature of life in that atmosphere. That's the thing that we're working on building now. Oh, and of course, we will do more solar system science as well. You know, so there's whoever the Heidi Hamble of today is, we'll do that. So I hope that you've enjoyed this. There's so many more discoveries that are coming with JWST. This telescope, I didn't talk about the amazing technical aspects of it, but it was a tough thing to build. It did take us 25 years to build. And it was a remarkable achievement of humanity, NASA, the European Space Agency, the Canadian Space Agency, thousands of people working together to make this. But I will tell you, it is only going to continue working if NASA science survives. And just this week, we heard that there may be a 50% cut to the NASA science budget. And that would devastate. That would be the end. I mean, literally, we're already talking about cutting back JWST observations, even now in our prime mission, because of funding cuts. And so if you like what you heard and you want more science from JWST and want more astrophysics, it's up to you to save NASA science. You need to write to your representatives in Washington and tell them that you like what you see and that you think that we as a nation, as a species, should be doing this kind of work. They don't listen to people like me. Like, I'm just an astronomer. Of course they want telescopes, but they listen to you because you're constituents. So please, if you want to have missions like JWST continue or missions in the future, now is the time to act, truly is. And Planetary Society can help you with that. So I wanted to end though on a positive note, because it's been the honor of my life to be a scientist for this mission. And so I wanted to share a quote from Carl Sagan. For people of my age, he was an icon in planetary science. And I knew Carl Sagan, I've worked with him. He said, "For all of our failings, despite our limitations and fallibilities, we humans are capable of greatness." JWST is an example of that. It is a great project that was made possible by 20,000 people working together around the globe. to produce wonderful science from the edge of the universe right here to our local neighborhood. And it's been an honor for me to participate. And I hope you've enjoyed that whirlwind tour. So thank you very much. And now I think we have time. I'm looking at my, time for questions. Yeah, yes, sir. The temperature of the telescope. It's really cold, but the sun hits this part of the telescope. And so on this part of the telescope where the sun hits it, out at L2 where it is, it's about minus, I wish I knew these numbers on the top of my head, but it's extremely cold, like minus 200 degrees Fahrenheit.
What about Kelvin?
Oh, in Kelvin. Oh,
I think the instrument package is around.
Yeah. So the instrument, what we have is these sun shields, and they reduce the amount of warmth. And then we actually have what's called a cryo cooler. That is something that runs to keep the instruments cold. And our MIRI instrument, our mid-infrared instrument, is cryo-cooled to 7 Kelvin. 7 Kelvin, 7 degrees above absolute zero. Yeah. Yes.
I have two questions, but I'm going to ask the main one first. I noticed while we were looking at Neptune and going through the mid-infrared, that's mid-infrared, yes?
Mm-hmm.
The range, I'm guessing, from the near part of the mid-infrared to the far part of the mid-infrared.
Yeah.
I noticed that there were spots where there was data missing. I'm guessing that is because of temperature changes. The heat interfering with the instrument.
It's more that it's some of these wavelengths. The planet itself is so cold that we didn't integrate long enough to be able to detect it at those wavelengths. So if we wanted to get images at those particular wavelengths, we would have to do longer integrations. We did not have infinite amounts of time, so we had to be very, long enough to get good data, but maybe not long enough to get to all of the wavelengths. And so that's what you were seeing when it looked like it just disappeared and it was a blank thing. Those were there's so much absorption from whatever molecule was at that wavelength that you would have had to integrate much longer than we had the time for. Yeah, I mean, I used to do this from the ground, like before JWST existed. Uranus was even harder because Uranus is even colder than Neptune, even though it's closer to the sun. And there's a long story behind that, which we are just writing a paper about right now. The team that I worked with, we had a special instrument at NASA's infrared telescope, and we all worked together. And so there were people doing comets and people doing stars. And I was always trying to do Uranus. And every time it was my turn, like to do Uranus, there's like, oh, it's Heidi. It's the definition of zero again. Because we would integrate for like 4 hours. And the spectrum would be like flat. We couldn't see anything. But now with JWST, you can see it, so zero no more.
And the other question I had was regarding the glow on the atmosphere of Jupiter on the dark side. I'm going to go ahead and call that air glow now, because that's exactly what it looks like. It's air glow, basically?
Yeah, kind of.
That was literally my question. It's like sort of like air glow, right?
It's like air glow. Yeah, it's like air glow. We don't actually have a paper out yet, so until I get actually a paper that I can read, I can't tell you the details of it. But it's like that, yeah.
I always got like this thought of like, those time lapses of the ISS orbiting on the dark side of the Earth, and you can see this like greenish line just above the heaven. I always wonder, if you were in low Jupiter orbit, how would that look like?
There's a lot going on in the polar regions of Jupiter. I mean, it isn't just the auroral rings that you see. There's footprints from the moons, because the magnetic field lines go out and they intersect with the orbits of moons like Io and Europa. And those are very dynamic. Like Io is a hugely volcanic moon, so it's spewing out all kinds of sodium and sulfur. And so when the magnetic field lines go through it, they pick up ions that then they show up in the magnetic footprint near the auroral oval. And so those ovals are super, super complicated. The movie that I saw like last week was just unbelievable. And so it's going to be great when that comes out for real. Yeah.
It's great stuff. Other questions? And what objects that I didn't say that you might be curious of?
Mine was more of an instrumentation question. So how do you actually split up the spectrum? How does that work?
Okay, so for the near spec instrument, the near infrared spectroscopic instrument, that was built by the European Space Agency, and it has what we call micro shutter arrays. And so every one of the sensors has a micro shutter that will open, and it can then disperse light through that opening, kind of like a mini slit, little mini slit. We actually have multiple ways of doing this, and I'm kind of waving my hands because there's so many different ways. We have slitless spectroscopy. We have grisms, which are like gratings and prisms that work together. We have the microshutter arrays. So it depends on exactly what wavelengths you want to look at with what resolution, which of the modes you would use to do spectroscopy. Yeah.
Are there questions?
What?
Just checking.
Oh, yeah. Zoom questions. So do we have any questions online? There, chat. Should I stop sharing maybe?
No, you should be fine. I don't see anything in chat.
Okay.
Hey, online world, y'all can... Anyone? Anyone? All right, we're going to go back to the room.
Yep.
I see something about understanding formation of the solar system and the age of the solar system. I wonder if you could say more about like how we could figure that out or some aspects of it.
Yeah. So what we're finding, first of all, when we looked at the Kuiper Belt, even before we had JWST, we could see that the orbits of Kuiper Belt objects were sorting themselves into classes. There were some that we called cold classical, and they were in the plane of the solar system and kind of looked like you would expect from things that formed in the plane of a solar system dust. Then there were others that were called scattered disks. Pluto is like one of these, where it has sort of a tilted orbit and it kind of got out of the plane of the solar system. So something had been interacting with this. And then in the early 1990s, a theory called migration was developed. And what we saw, we saw that some clusters of Kuiper Belt objects were in resonances with Neptune. And Pluto is one of these. And so this idea of migration, that planets, the giant planets that we see today, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune, they didn't form where they are now. They formed in different places, but then over millennia, they migrated. Jupiter, Saturn moved in, Uranus and Neptune moved out. And as Neptune moved into the Kuiper Belt, it started to gravitationally stir it up. And that's what caused the scatter disk. And then the cold classical was ones that didn't interact. And there was other things too. What we're adding with JWST to that is not just the dynamics, but the actual chemistry. We are seeing that, you know, I showed there was like these bowls, double dips, and cliffs. And what we're seeing is that in these different classes, things like nitrogen only appear in certain classes. And things that have carbon dioxide only appear in certain classes. And so what that tells us is in this primitive solar nebula of dust and gas, there are things that you might have heard called the snow line. If you get far enough away from the sun, water will condense, right? And that's the snow line. But there's a water snow line, but now there's a carbon dioxide snow line and a nitrogen snow line that we never could see before. We didn't have the data. Now we have the data and we know where the objects are now. And we know where they had to be when they formed, so we can start to track their history from where they had to have formed to where they are now. And so when I say the story of the solar system, those are the threads that we are now pulling out that we could never do before. And when I showed you that, I showed you that other one with all the other solar systems, because when you hear the folks who study those, they talk blithely about the snow line here and the snow line there. And they have these great theories, But they're not grounded in any data, really, you know. And so now we have data, at least data in our solar system, that we can link the physical bodies, where they are, to where they must have been when they formed. And so it's opening completely new windows into these processes of how systems form. Yeah. Yes.
I'm coming at this from just above ignorance. So if my questions are...
There's no bad questions. Okay.
So, first of all, do we have a spectra of Earth?
So not from JPL, but yes, we do. Mm-hmm.
Is there ever a situation where you could or you might want to reverse it and say, can you create a picture of an object with a spectra that looks like this?
We do that all the time now. That's a really great question, because this whole concept of exoplanets, planets around other stars, we are trying to get to the point where we can figure out what they might look like by only knowing what their spectra are. We don't have pictures of any of them. And so, yeah, by using Earth as an analog and saying, well, we know what Earth looks like, we know what its chemistry is, therefore, what would Earth look like from 10 parsecs away, right?
Right, right, right.
Yeah, that's an active field of research right now.
Okay.
It's, yeah, yeah. And that telescope I mentioned at the end, the Habitable Worlds Observatory, that's its raison d'etre, is to be able to look at Earth-like planets around sun-like stars. Like right now, JWST... it was not built to look at exoplanets, right? It was built to look at galaxies at the edge of the universe. But it's doing a quarter of its science as exoplanets because they're so awesome and so exciting. But it is not the tool to find the chemistry of an Earth-like planet around a sun-like star. It's just that sun-like stars are too bright. And so JWST is concentrating on what we call red dwarf stars, M-dwarfs. They're like really small red stars. But the planets, because the star is small and cool and not so bright, it's easier to see the planet. And so people have thought, okay, well, we'll look at like the TRAPPIST system. TRAPPIST has 7 Earth-sized planets around this star. And some of them are too close, too hot. And some of them are too far away and too cold, but some are in the Goldilocks zone, right? Just right. And so one of the key targets for exoplanets was these TRAPPIST planets. And they were hoping to find signatures of water, and they haven't yet. And everyone is like, what is this telling us about M-dwarf stars? What's that telling us about stars like our sun, which are brighter? And maybe to have life, you need to have, it can't be an M-dwarf. There's a big argument about this, still is. It's a raging topic of debate. Can you have a living Earth around an M-dwarf? Well, so far JWST is saying doesn't seem to be. We're still, you know, digging down and trying, but this new telescope that we're designing is designed specifically to answer this question.
And
yeah.
So the when you said the this is unrelated to the spectrum, the asteroid. Could we knock it and break it apart? Could that, if we were going to write our representatives to say this needs to be funded, would that be something that should be brought into the conversation?
Yeah, we are absolutely bringing in this question of what we call at NASA planetary defense, defending the Earth. And you know, this was a wake up call. This one that was found on Christmas Day. And for a while, it had like the highest percentage chance of hitting the Earth, not the highest ever. There was another one, Apophis, that was higher, but really high. And so we were taking it really seriously. It was never serious enough that you guys should be worried, right?
Right.
It never got that bad.
Right.
But it was serious enough that it was warranted astronomer attention. And so, yeah, this question of whether or not JW Hubble, they can be used for planetary defense, it is really very important. And I'll just share with you,
that it's going to become a topic you'll be hearing more about in the future, because later this year, there's a new telescope coming online in Chile called the Rubin Observatory. And Rubin Observatory is an all-sky southern telescope every 3 days. It'll see the entire southern sky in 3 days, and then again in 3 days, and again in 3 days. It's going to do that for 10 years. It is going to find a lot more potentially hazardous objects. And so it's not that they're new. They've always been there, but we are now developing the tools to find them. And so the follow-up work of determining their orbits and their sizes, that's critically what JWST can do, is the sizes. With its infrared capability, we could figure out how big they are. That's an important part. So yeah, if you want to write not only the fundamental science, but even defending the Earth, it's important. Yes.
I'll do a little follow on that. I'm actually the webmaster for the International Asteroid Warning Network, which is part of the IAU piece of Planetary Defense Office here at NASA. The acting director for PDCO is Kelly Fast, who is a alum of UMD, actually. But one of the things with 2024 YR4 was that it was extremely faint. And so all of the standard follow-up observers were having a great deal of difficulty. And we were looking at bringing in all of the big gun telescopes, which we normally wouldn't have access to for planetary defense, because you can't justify the money for it if other smaller telescopes can do it. But they were getting ready to, because if they didn't get some observations by the end of April, it would have been 4 years before we could get new observations, and they didn't want to have that looming over us. So they were really, really trying to get those observations.
Yeah, that's why we got the JWST time, in part, was because we could still see it with JWST. Yeah. There were enough observations with smaller telescopes to rule it out. It still might hit the moon, by the way.
Yeah.
The moon is actually still in the error ellipse.
Outside of PDCO's domain. We don't really care. It'll be interesting for everyone else.
Might be fun to watch, if it hits the moon. But that's one reason. And once the probability went down, to zero, our team went back to the Institute Space Telescope and said, okay, this is dropped. It's not a crisis anymore. I helped draft this letter. It's like, we understand if you don't want us to observe. And then they said, no, we gave you the time. You should go ahead and do it. And if you can demonstrate, you can measure the size of it, that's a really good exercise for the next time. And we will know. And so that's why the observations are happening right now. So,
Did I understand you to say that JWST spectra are revealing lines that we don't see in the laboratory?
Yep.
It's incredible.
Yeah. So at these meetings, the one I was at in January, there was half a day was about laboratory spectroscopy. What wavelengths, what pressures, temperatures do we need to focus on so that we can actually start to make identifications of these things, whether it's not only for Kuiper Belt objects and even in giant planets? How can we not know a line in a giant planet? And then, dust clouds, interstellar dust clouds, molecular clouds, there are things that we are not identifying. And even galaxies. It's very, I told you, when a spectrum goes up on the screen at an astronomy conference now, people are gasping because what they're seeing there, they just don't even know what to do with it, right? They just don't have the support data to analyze it. So we have this race in astronomy where you have theory and you have data, right? And laboratory work. And sometimes the laboratory work is ahead and you're always trying to get data to match the laboratory. JWST has leapfrogged that. And now we have data that is so far better than our laboratory data that we are people are tooling up their labs. They have to get colder. They have to get higher spectral resolution because that's the only way they're going to identify these lines in the spectra. It's kind of fun.
Yeah.
She says there's questions in the chat.
Hold on.
You can read them. Yeah. I can't read them.
Yeah. Okay. So Paul asked, what is the typical resolution of your spectrums? What is the R number?
Oh, Paul, I'm sorry. I don't have that at my fingertips because we have whole websites devoted to that information. So there's a JDocs, J-D-O-X. Probably you can go and find that out. But you could tell from the spectra that I showed that some of it is very high spectral resolution. Do you happen to remember any of those numbers? I just don't remember it. Sorry.
J.H. Miller says, is there any use to search for Planet Nine?
Oh, good question. So Planet Nine is a putative large planet in our solar system. The evidence for Planet Nine is the orbits of some of these very distant Kuiper Belt objects. The orbits of these ones that seem to be clustering in a way that suggests there's another body out there that's perturbing their orbits. JWST is not the telescope that we would use to search for Planet Nine. JWST is a small field of view, and so it is not a good search telescope. But the Rubin telescope that I mentioned, which is going to do all sky imaging, also the Nancy Grace Roman Space Telescope. What?
NEO Surveyor, I think.
NEO Surveyor? No, I don't think, because it's looking towards the sun. It's looking for sun grazers. And this thing is thought to be further out. But some of the big survey telescopes, like Rubin and Roman, they might be the ones that could detect it. Then JWST would zoom in and actually do really targeted spectroscopy of it. So it's not the finder, but it's the characterizer. So thanks for that question.
Great. And then one last question from online. Gary asks, what is the general health of JWST and what is its predicted life for the instrument?
So the health of JWST right now is excellent. When we crafted the telescope for a nominal 5-year mission with a potential extension for 10 years. And the limiting factor of that was the hydrazine fuel that we use to keep JWST in a little tiny halo orbit around the L2 point, the Lagrange 2 point. But the launch that we got from the Ariane 5 rocket from the European Space Agency was so good that it put us almost exactly on the right orbit. And so we have tons of extra hydrazine. And we have enough hydrazine, which is the only expendable on a spacecraft, to last for 20 years. Now, some of you might have heard about micrometeoroid impacts on the mirrors, because remember, the mirror is sitting out in outer space. There is no tube protecting it. And in May, we launched on Christmas in 2021. And in May of 2022, there was a pretty large micrometeoroid strike on mirror C3. And it was enough that we noticed it. But we had the engineers had planned for micrometeoroid strikes over the 10-year lifetime, and strikes of that size had been predicted. Now, people got worried because it happened right away, and they're like, oh, is something wrong? But there have been quite a few more micrometeoroid strikes, but they've all been very small, what we expected. So in other words, it's within the norm of what we'd expect. So that is not a life-limiting factor at this point. Now, space is hard, and you're out there in outer space. If you get a cosmic ray in the wrong part of the electronics, there's nothing you can do, right? But in terms of the functionality of the engineering of this spacecraft, it is solid. And at this point, it's good to go for 20 years.
Now, yeah. I always thought that the media sort of gave ESA short shrift for such a perfect launch.
The American media tends to do that. But, you know, those of us who talk about it, we always give full credit to our ESA partners, because that launch was spectacular. It was perfect. It was really awesome. And I want to mention, too, our Canadian partners. The Canadian Space Agency built the fine guidance system that we use for the steering and built one of the instruments, the nearest instrument. So it was truly a multinational effort. Although NASA was the lead, it was a NASA-ESA-CSA collaboration. And the new telescope that we're talking about, the Habitable Worlds, will also be a multinational, for sure, a multinational collaboration.
Let me see. You and then you, okay. Yeah, right here.
Oh, me.
Yeah.
I was just going to mention that the Vera Rubin and Nancy Gross Roman, many of you know, were members of NCA.
Members, yeah. The two women who the our next two major survey telescopes were both from this area, lived right here.
Members of NCA.
And members of this club, absolutely. Yeah.
And Nancy was quite active too. She would very often come to the meetings.
And
she asked great questions.
Yes.
Yep. Yes.
I guess you worked with Carl Sagan related to the Voyager. I wondered if you had any anecdotes to share about working with him.
I'll just share this one anecdote. So, one of my first science projects as a graduate student, I was studying Jupiter's moon Io. And I was looking at the reflectance of Io when it was coming out of eclipse. When it was in eclipse, it was dark, and it comes out of eclipse, it comes into the sunlight. And we'd known that Io doesn't just brighten. Sometimes it stays dark and then gets really bright. And other times it kind of got really bright and then dark. It was really crazy. And so I did a lot of observations, and we went to a big meeting, and I stood up as a grad student to give my talk about Io. And right there was Carl Sagan in the front row. And he had studied Io. He was all into like the chemistry of sulfur. He's in chemistry, right? And so I was like, oh my God. I'm like, but I gave my talk, right? As a grad student, well, I gave my talk. It was fun and fine. And then just like an hour later, I got in the elevator and Carl got in the elevator with me. And he said, that was a very nice talk, young lady. And I'm like, oh, thank God. So that was like my thing. He then, I met him many times over the years. And in fact, during Shoemaker-Levy 9, when the comet fragments left these huge black spots on Jupiter, right, from the impacts, this burned up Jupiter atmosphere, Carl came to the institute where we were all working and sat down with the science team, which I was the lead of, to talk about how the chemistry in Jupiter's atmosphere could create they're called tholins, T-H-O-L-I-N. And we talked about the chemistry that could be happening at Shoemaker-Levy 9. So it was kind of like all full circle, you know, from the timid graduate student in the elevator to like now leading the science team, working with Carl on understanding chemistry. So yeah, it's been a part of my life that way. Yes.
And what's the question you want on the favorite object? That's one, and the other is, can you guess at the kinds of objects that may have been ejected by Jupiter or Saturn a long time ago from Newton's observations? Make guesses.
Yeah. So that's an interesting question. We definitely know that Jupiter, being the largest planet in our planetary system, has played a huge role in stirring up the protoplanetary objects that are there. It's hard for us to guess what it has ejected because they're gone, right?
Right.
But what we can look at is what is left. And we can track the orbits of objects from the Kuiper Belt all the way through to clusters of what we call Jupiter family comets. These are objects that have interacted with Jupiter enough that they're locked into a resonance with Jupiter. And Jupiter also has what we call Trojans. Have you heard of the Trojan asteroid, the Trojan moons? So if you're looking at the solar system, like from the top, and so the sun's in the middle and Jupiter's going around, when Jupiter's up here, there's a whole cluster of objects here and here that move around with Jupiter. Those are the Trojans. And so by looking at the different chemistries of these Jupiter family comets, Trojans, and other things, we can kind of get a sense of how Jupiter affected that early solar nebula. But what's happening in the Kuiper Belt is really more what Neptune is doing. Neptune is the object that has been stirring up the Kuiper Belt. It's been moving into the Kuiper Belt, disturbing the orbits of those objects, capturing some in resonances, casting some out. So it's really more like Neptune and what it's doing that is the more interesting question for solar system formation right now. So I don't know if I answered your question.
Sorry, yeah. I'm trying to figure out how that might eventually tell us how Earth is in our solar.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's the good question, isn't it? That's the thing we all want to know. How is it that in our solar system, in our planetary system, we have a planet that we know is habitable, is inhabited, right? And are there other places in our solar system that may have at one time been habitable? Could Mars have been habitable at some point in its past? I mean, the rovers there looking at the chemistry of the rocks on Mars are saying there are places where it looks like there had been standing water at some time. And how long? Long enough? Where did the ingredients for life come from? I think I just saw recently, I just saw a talk recently, but when I recently, within the last 3 weeks, where they identified some of the key components that go into making life. They just identified them in some Kuiper Belt objects. And I'm like, I didn't hear about this. I was telling the person. They're like, yeah, because we just did it. I'm like, oh, okay. Well, then I don't feel so bad that I hadn't heard about it. We're starting to get to the point in the of our chemistry of knowing where we can find these elements that lead to life here on Earth. But it's an open question. And the question of whether or not, if it formed in our planetary system, we now know, when you go outside tonight and look up there and see stars, we now know that every star that you're looking at has a planetary system around it. And then we also know that every galaxy that we look at is filled with stars, and they all have planetary systems. So what are the conditions like in some of those other planetary systems? Do they have statistically the conditions like we had? And does that mean that life could form? And doesn't, when I say life, I'm not talking about aliens. I'm mostly talking about like bacteria, right? Things that would change a planet's atmosphere. Like the oxygen in our atmosphere came from bacteria, right? We know that by studying the history of our planet. So the questions you're asking are like, these are the questions we're asking in planetary astronomy right now. And what's most exciting is we are now getting the data that we can start to actually answer the questions. We could be the people that actually find evidence for life on another world around another star. We have the tools, and we are now getting the understanding. When I was a kid, this is all science fiction, and it was all like, you know, Star Trek, right? But now it's real. This,
we had nine planets.
What?
We had nine planets.
Yeah, we had nine planets back then. It's a whole nother talk. Give it another time. Yeah.
Are we refining Drake's equation?
Yes, we are refining Drake's equation. Many different pieces of it. Yeah, right.
Yeah, our speaker last month, I think his name was Matt Clement. He was talking about simulations they've done of protoplanetary disks and how often the big guy kicks out all the other planets.
Yeah.
And it seemed like it was pretty rare that they were able to come up with something like ours. There would be very few cases where you would have four terrestrial planets. They might have one or two.
I think it depends on who you're talking to and the models they're doing, because there are other modelers of planetary systems who have been looking at exoplanets, where they're finding that a lot of these have multiple Earth-sized planets in them. And so, you know, your models are as good as your models, I guess, is the way I would put it. I think one of the reasons that I am excited about the state of astronomy and planetary science today is that our tools are getting to the point where we can actually constrain these models. Like I showed you a picture of dozens of protoplanetary disks. That's data. That isn't a model. And now with our exoplanet studies,
We are now up, last I checked, 5,400 or 5,700. I didn't check. It's when I give my exoplanet talk, I always update the numbers. But we now have thousands of planetary systems. And so I don't think it's as rare as he may have been suggesting.
We have a speaker, I think, named Stevenson from APL in a couple of months. And he's, I believe his talk is on rocky planets using JWST.
Yeah.
Rocky planets looking for atmospheres.
Yeah.
Earth-like rocky planets right. with atmospheres. And so far, they're hard to find.
You'll hear a lot about the TRAPPIST system. Yeah, that's the archetype for that. Yeah. Yes.
So while looking at data that is age probably true to how much the redshift, have you noticed that the spectra does or does not match the heavy metal prediction of the time that they are supposed to be?
So I don't know the answer to your question because that's not the field that I work in. I will offer this, that the initial observations of the earliest galaxies that we saw, the surprising thing was the brightness and the complexity of the earliest galaxies. They showed a lot of structure. Now, it's extremely difficult to get spectroscopy of those earliest galaxies. So I don't know the answer to your question.
What the range where you do get enough spectroscopy and then you see the metals matching the time period that they predicted to be, because as generations of stars happen, the ratio of metals will change.
Yeah, well, I mean, one of the things we were hoping to see was the very first stars, the POP 3 stars, the pure hydrogen stars. We haven't seen them yet. So I think that there's no disagreement yet that I'm aware of, but a caveat that it's not my field. I'm a solar system person, so I'm not the right person to ask that. You'll have to get a different speaker, an early universe speaker.
Final question.
The main belt comets. I expect that probably very early in the solar system, all of the main belt asteroids, or what are now main belt asteroids, had volatile ice and they all lost them. Or otherwise, then why are there a few that do and most don't? So basically, is there an understanding of either their why there are still a few that do, or they're conversely they I was thinking of the converse earlier and can't quite think of it now, but basically why are there all the asteroids that do not have but volatile water, and just a few that apparently do.
So one of the challenges in studying the hydration, the water content in asteroids, is that we have a lot of water in our atmosphere. And so the lines are that where we would see them in the asteroids, we have those lines in our atmosphere. It's very hard to disentangle them. So one of the things that we were very interested in doing with JWST is looking at wavelengths where we're no longer contaminated by the Earth's atmosphere. And so there are certain hydration lines in regular asteroids, not main belt comets, but regular asteroids, that we're looking for the hydration, how much water is there. And the water is thought to be there. It's just locked into the materials. It's something we call clath rates. That's a geological term where there's a kind of a crystalline structure. I'm kind of making this up a little bit, but the water is locked into the structure. Now you've got to remember that the asteroid belt is heavily processed,
right?
You know, heavily processed with collisions, Jupiter stirring it up.
And all of those collisions and all those interactions, smashing them apart, families that smash other families, that releases a lot of this stuff. And so you have to be, it's a very complicated story for the asteroid belt. But there has been evidence for hydration in other asteroids, all right? But never in a main belt comet, the comet with the coma.
Right.
So the question was always, what was driving the coma there?
Right.
Yeah, I hope I'm answering your question, kind of, sort of.
Sort of.
Yeah.
And I know that really the difference between an asteroid and a comet is that the comet has enough ice to evaporate and form a coma.
It's so, very gray.
Right.
The gradient. So we get,
you talked to Jessica Sunshine. She considers asteroids to be dead comets.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. It's a continuum. It's kind of an artificial construct to say this is an asteroid,
right.
That is
right.
A comet. You know, that's a centaur.
Right.
And so,
why are the I'm wondering why are there still a few, you know, that do have enough to form a coma? And
well, that's a great question. Why are there 16
yeah.
out of tens of thousands of main belt asteroids.
Or I guess the converse was, why aren't there many, many more of them?
Well, like I said, it could just be there's been so much processing.
Would they be recent captures?
I don't know about that. Not in the asteroid belt. I don't think so. I think that they're primordial. I think they formed there, but I don't know. I mean, that this is a topic of great debate right now. All of the things I talked to you are, there's kind of everything is on the edge right now because it's all brand new data. So
some of the comet group people that I work with here at UMD have looked at some of the main belt comets and such. And a lot of times some of them become active after a recent impact or something. And so basically unearthing or basically excavating down into deeper layers and releasing any ices that may have been at deeper layers, because there's like a heavy, you know, regolith may not be the right word, but basically there's this heavy layer of stuff that's kind of insulating whatever's inside. So
burst the bubble.
Yeah.
So. Well, thank you for all those great questions. It was a pleasure talking with you all tonight.
Well, thank you.
So we will go observe. I just need to do a few things with my computer here. And then I guess I'm not going to be